We'll start on page 4. We'll learn about Pirkei Avot. Pirkei Avot, between Pesach and Shavuos, Jewish people all over the world study the ethics of our fathers. Ethics of our fathers is from the Talmud. It's tractate in the Talmud. Most of the Talmud is about laws, regulations, what's allowed, what's not allowed, what is pure, what is impure, and so on. There is one tractate in the Talmud that speaks about ethics. But these ethics were not made by, didn't come because what everybody decided, what is the ethical thing to do. It's based on the Torah and on Sinai and on what God said, what God taught us. Now, what's unique about Pirkei Avot, besides this, that it's teaching us ethics, the rabbis, when they put together Pirkei Avot, the Tanoic rabbis who were living 2,300 years ago in the middle of the Second Temple, they wanted to preserve the chain of tradition. In Judaism, chain of tradition is a very important thing. Who received the Torah from whom? There is a clear list. Who is the next rabbi who was the main chief rabbi who received the Torah, and who is after him? Maimonides, in his introduction to his book, Mishneh Torah, to his book that he has a code of Jewish law that covers every law in Jewish law, from the time of the temple, from now, everything. Then he provides a list of all the rabbis from Mount Sinai all the way to the end of the Talmud. Who are the rabbis that this rabbi received from this rabbi, and so on and on and on. The same thing, that was Maimonides was after the Mishnah. Maimonides wrote it 900 years ago. The Talmud, this was written 2,300 years ago, 2,200 years ago, something like this. Then they already wanted to preserve the chain of tradition because it's very important to know the authenticity of the Torah. It's not somebody showed up and started to teach Torah. It's all the first question they ask you, who gave you the smicha? Who gave you the authority to teach Torah? Who gave you the certificate of ordination to be the rabbi? And whenever a rabbi comes up with an idea, they right away ask him, where is this written? I get it all days. Source. One word, source. Like what you're telling me stories here, who said it? Where is this written? And I try to write as many sources as possible, but no matter how much you write, somebody will always show up from somewhere. Source. Even for Vinay, when he writes about politics or things like this, people ask me, where's the source? In any case, then how they did it, Pirkei Avot is the book that describes, that writes down, tells us, makes sure that we'll know who received the Torah from whom. Moses received the Torah from Sinai. He gave it over to Joshua. Joshua gave it to the elders. The elders were a whole group of leaders over a period of a few hundred years. Then it started the prophet. Then after the prophet, the people of the great assembly. Then the Mishnah started to mention names of rabbis. Who was next after whom? But how they did it? They did it in a way, you need to understand, the Mishnah was not written. The Mishnah was taught before, Jewish law originally forbid it to write down oral tradition. You can only write down, the Bible must be written. The commentary to the Bible is not allowed to be written. Until came Rabbi Yehuda the prince, who lived the 1900 years, and he broke the law, if you want. He said, you're allowed. He decided that if we will not write down the Torah, everything will be forgotten. The Jews were exiled all over. It's going to be over. He broke the law and he started to write it down. But when the Mishnah was put together, it was before Rabbi Yehuda the prince. They call him a Rebbe, before Rebbe. And it was a few hundred years before Rebbe. And now you're going to remember names. Rabbi Akiva said, and Rabbi Hillel, and this, all the names. Then to every name, that they attached a statement. What he used to say, a message in his name. And in this way, you remember, Hillel said, love, peace, and be from the disciples of Aaron, love, peace, and pursue peace, love creatures, and bring him closer to the Torah. Then when you hear such a message, you remember what remember Hillel that you meant. The next message it was Rosh Hashanah. I said then everyone what he said. Then in this way you remember what the names. That was a brilliant way out to make sure that you remember the names. Now, what the rabbis made a statement is not just they made a statement. They just said something nice, you know. Churchill said, and then Lincoln said another thing. Many smart people said many things. But by them, it was more than that. They said something that they lived by it. That was the statement that guided their life. And they were living by this statement. They were a living example to this statement. When Hillel said, love peace and love every creature, he lived by it. He loved every human being. Nobody can ever get him upset. There is stories in the Talmud how much people bet with each other to get Hillel angry. And they lost the bet. Because nobody was able to make him angry. And by the end, when the guy tells him, I'm very angry with you because I lost a bet because of you, I lost so much money. He told him, it's worth it for you to lose the money and I shouldn't be angry. I shouldn't lose my temper.
He wasn't married?
His wife was mad at him, not him.
Yeah. And the Jewish wife, he was afraid of her.
She agreed.
Rabbi, how much time would it take the typical rabbi to study and read the Mishnah, the Talmud, and to like know it and internalize it?
The whole Talmud? I mean, it's a lifetime. It's a lifetime of learning. People don't understand. For people to really make it, you have to dedicate your life to it. It's not you do, 15 minutes in the evening. It's a whole lifetime. It's not like you never graduate. You can get a rabbinical ordination. Where's your mother?
Yes, getting her coffee.
Oh, no problem. And the rabbinical
morning coffee.
No problem. The rabbinical ordination you get, and you learn for a year, for 2 years, a certain amount of learning. But to really, learning in Judaism is a lifetime journey. You learn and you learn more, and you never learn everything. There is some people who are geniuses to begin with. They're born with very special heads. They remember, they learn, and they know a lot. But the most of the people learn a lifetime. They know more and more and more, but nobody knows everything. No such thing. Even the greatest scholars, they constantly come up with new ideas and deeper level of understanding. But it's not something that you learn and you know and you don't. No such thing.
That's the test, right?
Exactly. Now, most of, in secular society, there is many educated people, but not so many intelligent people. What I mean to say is, you understand what I'm saying? They want to learn, they go to college, they get their...
Smart degree.
They get a degree and they're done. They don't open it again, you understand? In Judaism, you constantly learn. A person should learn. A Jewish man, by law, every free moment is to learn Torah. It's very complicated to be a Jew. In any case, that's a Pirkei Avot. And everyone, when every rabbi who said something, he lived by it. He was an example. It's not just they took the statement... That was his mission statement. He preached it all the time. He lived by it. He did it. That was the mission statement. And that's what it's used in the Mishnah. That was so unique about Pirkei Avot. That every week, we learn on Shabbat afternoon, we learn one chapter. There are six chapters in Pirkei Avot, in Ethics of Our Fathers. There are six Saturdays between Pesach and Shavuos. Every Saturday afternoon, we study one chapter. That's the tradition. Actually, many, many Jews, Chabad included, study a whole summer. Why we study it in the summer? Because in the summer, the life is good and everybody is running around. Then we need a little more focus on ethics. What's the right thing to do? Now, ethics of our fathers means it's not just you do, there is doing the letter of the law and go beyond the letter of the law. Doing what is, you want to be better than just the minimum. When you try, if you look on God as just an authority, you don't want to get involved in trouble with the police. Did you say? That's the law. That's the minimum. It's like the IRS. I do the minimum. I try to cut every corner possible, right? People try to cut. It's fine. But if you're looking at the relationship between a father and a son, between God, who you love, and you want to please him, and you want to get closer to him. You're trying to do everything the best, not everything the worst, not the minimum. You're trying to do the maximum. And that's what the Mishnah, the ethics of our fathers, teach us to do, the maximum, not just the minimum. You want to go behind it. And that's what Jews throughout history didn't try just to get away with it. They tried to do the best way. It's called Idu Mitzvah. Many mitzvahs that we do, we don't do just the minimum. We do much more than the minimum. And it's built in much more than just the minimum. It means to say you want to build up a relationship with God. When I sin, I ruin the relationship. Then I said, God, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. God said, okay, I'm sorry, I forgive you. Just get out of here. Just like your wife tells you sometimes, I forgive you. Get away from my face. Then the same thing is, we want, but we don't want to get away from God's face. We want to build up the relationship. This way I show goodwill. I show the extra mile. That's what it's all about. And now we're going to start to actually read it from inside. There is, later if you want, you can take the booklet. There is two pages of introduction to it, but I think I gave you the gist of it. Go for it.
Jewish pride. Moses received the Torah at Sinai and passed it on to Joshua, who further passed it on to the elders, and the elders to the prophets, and the prophets to the men of the great assembly. They said three things. Be cautious in judgment, establish many students, and make a safety fence around the Torah.
Then this is the Mishnah. The Mishnah itself, the first Mishnah of Pirkei Avot of Ethics of Father, starts that Moses received the Torah from Sinai. He gave it over to Josh. He passed it over to Joshua to the elders, and so on. And then they say, who are the people of the great assembly? They will, as we will go to it, and we say then three statements in the name of the people of the great assembly. Okay. You want to continue? Okay.
Moses received the Torah at Sinai. I say, because this tractate is not based on understanding the Torah's mitzvot and legal precepts, like all other Talmudic tractates, but it is entirely ethics and morals. And similar secular works are also common. Therefore, the Tana began this Mishnah stating that Moses received the Torah at Sinai. The ethical and moral teaching it contains are not man-made, but were given by God at Sinai.
Okay. They were given by God of Sinai. Man-made ethics is up for change. Today, this is ethical. Tomorrow, this is ethical. In 2 weeks, even this is not ethical. Look how ethics changed in the last... everybody is canceled, and we're good. When Columbus was a good man, now he's a terrible guy. Everything changes. Everything is up for... It's on Sinai, it's forever. This is real. Ethics, and not human beings made it up. It's coming from God. Go ahead.
The word Bartanura.
Bartanura is the name of a commentary.
The name of a commentary, not the name of a wine.
Right.
That's the first thing that I saw this one. It's a
Rebbe Ovadia, it comes from the same place as the wine is coming. Rebbe Ovadia Bartanura, it came from Italy.
Yeah.
That's a Pesach wine.
I knew the name. The name of the commentator was much before the name of the wine.
Region, or is the name of a person?
No, the name of the region. But maybe that became the name of his person. All the rabbis, you need to understand, 500 years ago, nobody had a last name.
Bartanura is a kosher wine, so it's somehow it's a relation.
No. Rabbi Bartanura lived many, many, many years ago.
Okay.
Thousands.
Not thousands, no. Great. Probably 500 years ago. Go ahead, I'll check Sinai. Later. You check when Bartanura was.
From he who was revealed at Sinai.
Check now.
To the elders. They lived for a long time after Joshua, and they transmitted the Torah to other elders under the beginning of the prophetic period, led by Eli, the Kohen, and Samuel.
Okay, there was a time of judges, or called also in other places. After Joshua was Ataniel Beknaz and others, and then until the time of Samuel. By the time of Samuel, that became the official prophet is Samuel. And it was a type of leaders, they were called judges, elders, of a few hundred years probably, maybe 200 years, maybe less. Yeah, a little more probably, yeah, more than...
1455 to 1520.
I was right, exactly, 500 years ago.
His original name was spelled like that, but he's known as the Rabbi of Bartanura.
Bartanura, and the spelling is not my thing, you know. In Hebrew, it's all spelled the same.
In Italy, is that where it was?
Yeah.
In Italy, yeah. 500 years ago, yeah. And then he, until he came to the prophets, the time of prophets started with Eli and Samuel. Go ahead.
Men of the great assembly.
Who is the men of the great assembly? Go ahead.
120 elders. Zerubbabel, Sreah, Reliah, Mordechai, Bilshan. They returned from exile with Ezra. This body included Shaggai, Zechariah, Malachi,
Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, and Nehemiah, Ben Chachliah, and Chavrayim. Now you know. This is talking about the people of the great assembly. Was a great assembly that was established in the beginning of the Second Temple of 120 rabbis and prophets, and they made many, many rules. They established the whole concept of prayer. They put together the Amidah service that we pray. They established the basic way out to say blessing. Baruch Ata Hashem Elokeinu Melech HaOlam Asher Kidishanu Mitzvotav Tzivanu. They came up with this text. All the text of the prayer books, the main text of the prayer books, the basic of the prayer books was by the people of the Great Assembly. And many, many other things.
They collected from Babylon and Israel, right?
They came back from Babylon by the beginning of the Second Temple. Some of them left Israel and went to Babylon, then they came back. But that was an assembly of 120 people. And that's why in Israel, the Knesset is 120 Knesset members. Huh. They tried to be... recreate the people of the Great Assembly. It didn't work out so well. But that's what it's based on.
Yeah, they don't make things like they used to.
Now, then, to remember them, that's where it starts. The Mishnah says three things in the name of the people of the Great Assembly. It wasn't just three things that they said once. That was the mission statement. They told whenever they went, they said, that's what he's telling you. Here are three things that it's important for all of you to know. What are they? Want to continue?
They said three things, they said many things, but these three teachings are regarding the continuation of the Torah. Be cautious in judgment. If a judgment comes before you once, twice, and a third time, don't assume that the verdict is the same as the previous cases. But be cautious, meaning deliberate before passing judgment.
Means to say, when talking to the rabbis, to the judges, say people come to you with the same questions. I heard once from a rabbi, he was teaching a younger rabbi. He told them, listen, there are 50 questions that people ask. Once in a blue moon, you have a real serious question. Most of the questions are, you should know, every time you have a problem, you think you're the only one in the world. I'm telling you, 99% of society has the same problems. And the same thing, and that relaxes you. Yeah, everybody has the same sorrows with the same issues. He says, a person comes to you, with a question. You say, I heard the question 1,000 times. I can tell them the judgment right away. No. If two people come to you for a judgment, you have to listen like the first time and look it over and study it and think about it and research it just like it was the first time. That's the first message that they have. The second message is...
establish many students as opposed to Rabbi Gamliel, who said that any students whose inside and outside aren't equal should not enter the study hall. One should teach Torah to everyone without investigation, as long as they do not have a bad reputation.
Okay, we stop right here. Rabbi Gamliel was a rabbi in the time of after the Second Temple. He was the head of the Jewish people, basically. He was the Nasi, the president of the Jewish people, whatever you call it. And he had a policy that in his yeshiva, in the biggest yeshiva, only students who were very good were allowed to go in. Real honest, real God-fearing people. If you're not from important families and not from the real crowd, you're out. One time, he was a very strict leader because it was right after the destruction of the Second Temple and he felt that he has to establish shul. Not every rabbi is opening his own shul and he's doing whatever he wants. We need a central ruling. And what, if the Supreme Court decides to do a certain rule this way, everybody's doing it. Not, I disagree with them, I'll do it my way. Because then it will be no Torah. It will be 10 Torahs. It will be a disaster. But he was very strict. Once he insulted his deputy, his second in command, Rabbi Yeshua. And the crowd, and those was already the third time he kind of insulted them. And the crowd loved Rabbi Yeshua because he was a very nice guy and everybody loved him, and a very poor man, a very, you know, brilliant man and nice to everyone. Then the crowd booed Rabbi Gamliel. They booed him. And he had no choice. He had to stop his lecture in the middle. It's a whole long story. In any case, he was removed from his leadership. They said they need somebody else. And their partner, they appointed the guy.
Like a teenager, didn't they? It wasn't that.
Yeah. The guy from the Agada, Abelozo Ben Azariah. They appointed somebody who is 18 years old. The day he was removed from his yeshiva, from leadership, they opened the doors of the yeshiva, and 800 benches were added to the yeshiva.
Wow.
Hundreds and hundreds of students joined. Because this business and only the elite will come in was over. And that's what he says here. You should add many students, not like Rabban Gamliel's policy, that only these people who are real, committed, are allowed to come. Everybody is welcomed. There is a Talmudic statement, very interesting Talmudic statement, that says, and I'll give you this in your world, you understand. 1,000 kids come into kindergarten. 100 kids join high school. 10 kids go to college. And one becomes a professor. Then the more thousands of kids go into pre-kindergarten, the more professors you're going to have. You understand what's going on? It's a
game of numbers.
Game of numbers, you understand? Mm-hmm. Then it's and that's how it goes. The way the Talmud says it like this. Elef nichnatim lemikra. 1,000 children start to learn Chumash, learn the Bible. Mea nichnatim lemishna. 100 start to learn Mishnah. That's what we're learning now. Eser Ligmora. 10 learn Talmud. Not just the Mishnah, the Talmud. And one becomes a rabbi. Then the Rebbe used to mention that all the time. Here is we see where quantity adds to quality. The more quantity, the more chances for quality to come out. Because it's all a matter of how many people have an opportunity to become scholars. The more kids are, first of all, it's important that all the 1,000 should learn Torah, should be Jewish. But besides, for rabbis, that's what the Mishnah says here. You have to make many, many students, because all these many students will help you. You'll have more people become their students and their students and their students.
So is it common, or I'm sure it isn't, but you mentioned Rabbi Gamliel is not mentioned favorably.
This is a commentary.
Okay.
And by the way, Rabbi Gamliel himself regretted. He regretted. He says he felt bad. He said it's such a terrible thing that I didn't allow so many kids to learn Torah. Then in a dream, he saw in a dream that it's all ashes, so to speak. It's not real. Then the Talmud speaks about that. They had this dream. And Talmud says it was just to make Rabbi Gamliel feel better about himself. But really, it was the wrong thing to do. Mm. The Talmud brings this whole story.
But you don't
I'll tell you, I'll tell you, I'll
you
tell
you.
You
don't see Jewish, you know, the rabbis.
Yeah. You mention somebody unfavorably to learn a lesson from him. The tikkun of Rabban Gamliel, the correction of Rabban Gamliel is when we say, don't be like him. And sometimes you need to have somebody to say, don't be like him.
Mm.
You need a guy that you say, if you want, learn. If not, you'll look just like this guy. Mm. You need him too. Then the correction of Rabban Gamliel, that's called tikkun, the Rebbe speaks about Noah and about many examples. The tikkun of them is that we learn from them what not to do. That's an atonement for them. And that's justified what they did, because people should learn what not to do. Okay, and the last one, make a safety fence. Go ahead.
Make a safety fence around the Torah, a perimeter to ensure that one does not violate a biblical prohibition. For example, rabbinic prohibitions against illicit relationships and Shabbat laws, as the verse says, guard my commandments, meaning enact guards for my commandments.
What he says is like this. You should only make Judaism is busy with making fence for the Torah. For example, by Jewish law, you're not allowed to be with another woman in a private room, in the locked room, especially not at night. What you say, it's not written in the Torah. In the Torah it's written, you're not allowed to touch her, but you're not to be in the room. That's called a fence. You don't want to get in trouble. If you will not be in the same room, nothing bad will happen. And that's all the Me Too movement proved it. I mean, it all started from being in the wrong places in the wrong time. If you're not in the wrong place in the wrong time, then there is the same thing about Shabbat. For example, you're not allowed to touch a pen. Why? Really, you're not allowed to write. Why are you not allowed to touch the pen? It's called mukzeh. Because if you'll touch the pen, by mistake, you might write. Therefore, you tell you, don't touch it. That's all this is fences that the Torah, that the rabbis made. You shouldn't by mistake not do a sin. And that's what the people of the Great Assembly said, make a fence around the Torah. Okay. So far we learned the Mishnah. Okay, you want to continue, young man? First paragraph. What's special about Sinai? Okay.
We found the term Sinai used often. For example, Moses received the Torah from Sinai. The law given to Moses at Sinai. Everything a seasoned student will originate was already said to Moses at Sinai. And more is the significance of the term Sinai. The point that these statements are conveying in that God is the source. God is everywhere. So why is the term Sinai used?
The question that the Rebbe is asking, why is Judaism obsessed with Sinai? The Torah was, Moses didn't receive the Torah from Sinai, he received it from God. What sort of language is it? Sinai was a place, you don't even know where it is. By the way, you know why we don't know, the most practical explanation why we don't know where Sinai is? And they're just before the class, they asked me why we know all the gravesite in Israel and we don't know where Sinai is. And we don't know where Moses was buried. Right? Because on the most practical level, there was nobody living in the desert to preserve the tradition. In Israel, there were people living all the time. Therefore, one generation to the next. This is the Cave of Machpelah. This is Temple Mount. It was in Sinai. Nobody lived. It was a desert. People passed by. There was no next generation saying, no, here it is. Even in Israel, most of the places were preserved because of the Arabs. The Jews were not living for many generations. And we know that many things we know because the Arabs actually preserved the places. They respected them. That's the truth. Then the question is, why are we obsessed with the word Sinai? Moses received the Torah from God. Everything that a student learned is already was given at Sinai. Given by God at Mount Sinai. When the Torah was given on Shavuos. What's the obsession with Sinai? Who cares where it was? That's the question. If you don't even know where it is, who cares? Continue, John.
Okay, the sages relate that when the time of the giving of the Torah arrived, each mountain made an argument for why it should be the site for the giving of the Torah. Mount Tabor argued that it is the highest. Mount Carmel argued that it assisted the splitting of the sea, etc. God responded, "Why do you all desire the Torah? You are haughty, and this is a blemish. The mountain God desires to rest his presence on is Mount Sinai, the most humble of all mountains."
Obviously, the mountains didn't speak. But if they could speak, that's what they would argue. Man. We can argue on behalf of them. Like lawyers argue on behalf of people who are not even alive, on behalf of people who wanted to. Go ahead.
You know, maybe God didn't want it to be something that could be found because people would get preoccupied with it.
You're right. That's written too. Yes. Source number one. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Midrash Tehillim 65. When God wanted to give Torah to the Jewish people, Mount Carmel and Mount Tabor came before Hashem. Mount Tabor said, "I am fitting for God's presence, for I am higher than all mountains. Even the waters of the great flood did not reach me." Mount Carmel said, "I am worthy of the..."
Mount Tabor is in Israel. You know that.
So we know it.
How could the flood not reach that when the earth was covered?
It means to say the maybe it didn't reach because the flood did not go in Israel. You know that? the flood, Noah's and the flood that was in the time of Noah, was not flooding in Israel. Hmm. The rain did not go down in the land of Israel.
Everywhere but?
Everywhere but Israel. And, but there was so much water that it came to Israel too. But the flood itself did not rain in Israel. Okay, continue.
Mount Carmel said, I'm worthy of the Torah to be given to on me. When the sea split, I went into the water, and the Jews crossed the sea on me.
Whatever it means.
God is wanted to have disqualified yourself, for you are haughty.
The moment you start to say, I am special, you cannot receive the Torah. Continue.
The mountain retreated when you not reward us.
Then the mountain said, you will not reward us. You're not going to do something for us. God answered them.
God answered them, you will receive your reward during the time of the Deborah, the prophetess. The Jews will be victorious over the Sisera's army on the Mount Tabor during Elijah the prophet. Miracles will take place on Mount Carmel. However, I will choose another mountain for giving the Torah.
God says, I reward you. The Tabor mountain. There is a whole story about Deborah, the prophetess. It was a time that in the Palestinians, I don't remember what exactly the name is, they wanted to attack the Jewish people. And Deborah took Barak, the son of Avinoam, and they went to Mount Tabor. And on Mount Tabor became the big miracle of the Jewish people, where the Sisera, with his big army, got stuck. It was mud, it was a big rain, and all the chariots were stuck in the big mud, and they had to run away. It was heavy chariot. Then there was a miracle on Mount Tabor. It was a miracle on Mount Carmel. Elijah at Mount Carmel, the famous story, how he took he offered he built the altar and he offered a sacrifice, and a fire came down from heaven. It was a miracle. But for giving the Torah, we need the most humble mountain. Why?
I will choose Mount Sinai, the smallest of you, as a verse that why the lofty and the holy ones I dwell. With the lofty and the holy ones I dwell, and with the crushed and humble in spirit.
God, where is God? Where you can find God? People who have a humble spirit. There where God is. That's why God wanted to, says, my Torah will be given on the Mount Sinai, in the lowest mountain. Not on the highest mountain. Tavor says, I'm the highest. God did not look for the highest. God wanted to teach us a message. If you want to be able to learn Torah, you have to be humble. That was the message from Mount Sinai, in a small mountain. Okay, humility and pride combined.
The question can be asked, if humility is so important, the Torah should not have been given on a mountain at all, but in a valley,
mm-hmm.
or on a flat terrain. And if there is some importance to height, then the Torah should have been given on the mountains taller than Mount Sinai.
Make up your mind. If it's humbleness, let's go to a valley.
The answer is that the goal of the giving of the Torah was to combine these two opposing traits.
We need both. We ask from the Jew the impossible. Humble on one hand, and one be humble and being proud on another. In English, it's very good because pride and arrogance are two separate names. In Hebrew, it's the same word. You need to have pride, but not to be arrogant. But don't be like a schmate that everybody walks all over you. Humble is not a schmate. It's two separate things. Okay, continue.
What's the word in Hebrew for pride and arrogance, if it's the same?
Gava. Geut.
Gava?
Gava, yeah. Gimel Aleph Vave, yeah.
And it means the same? It means
It's the same meaning. No, it means arrogant and it means pride. You cannot separate it in arrogance and pride. In English, you say, I'm proud of it. It doesn't mean I'm arrogant. I'm proud of associating myself that I'm a part of, a member of the Jewish people. It doesn't mean that I'm going around like this. Oh, I'm so better than you. I mean, it's two separate. Pride is a positive thing. We're arrogant is a negative thing. In Hebrew, it's the same word. Go ahead.
Acceptance of the Torah requires both characteristics. We must be firm and proud and not be ashamed of those who mock our observance. The code of Jewish law opens with this. teaching us that we shouldn't bow to any foreign influences and study Torah and observe mitzvot with pride and strength. At the same time, we also need humility. The sages teach that God cannot stand haughty people, and Torah and mitzvot require humility. When my soul is like dust to all, then we can have an open heart to Torah.
By the end of the Amidah, we say this line, my soul is dust to all, and I ask from God that should ever open out to the Torah. The rabbi said, what is the condition for opening your heart to the Torah when your soul is dust to all? And Moses, on one hand, was a humble, the street, was the most humble person, but he didn't think he's a nothing. And he was very, a Jew should be very proud of his Judaism. People tell you, don't do it. Who are you to tell me not to do it? I'm going to do it. It's what God told me. I'm very proud of it. But it doesn't mean that I'm an arrogant person. It's two separate things. Then on one hand, you have to be humble. That's why God chose to give it on a mountain. But then a small mountain. On one end, you need to have a mountain. You need some pride. You need some backbone. On the other end, you have to be humble. This combination is asked from every Jew. To appoint the impossible. Well, that's possible. But it's complicated to be Jewish. It's not so simple. God is asking from you to be a little more refined, to understand pride and humble and all together.
Isn't it the same concept that you had the other day? You talked about you want to be in two places. You can't be in two places at once. You want to study Torah, but you have to work. And
you're right. You have to want to be in the synagogue, but actually to be in the workplace.
It's the same concept.
If you're all day in the synagogue, it's not good. God doesn't want it. If you're in workplace and you actually enjoy it too much, that's also not good. Be in the workplace and be miserable because you want to be in the synagogue. That's what God is asking from you.
Those are those same.
Pretty good
at being miserable. That's
pretty
a call.
Pretty good at being miserable, right? Huh? Pretty good at being miserable.
Exactly. That's why the Jews are always a little, you know.
I'm pretty miserable, right?
Okay, you want to continue, please?
Yehuda ben Tema says, be bold as a leopard, swift as an eagle, dressed as a deer, and strong as a lion to fulfill the will of your Father in heaven. Bold as a leopard means not to be ashamed before scoffers.
Okay. First of all, the Talmud, the code of Jewish law, well, the Alter Rebbe wrote a code of Jewish law, updated code of Jewish law. It starts with this Mishnah. That's a Mishnah also. Yehuda ben Tema says, be bold, we learn from animals certain character what you can copy. We can learn from emulate. Be bold as a leopard, swift as an eagle, fast as a deer, and strong as a lion, all to serve God. You learn from every one of the animals what something a lesson to your life. If you see something, it's a message here. What can I be like them? Then what means bold like a leopard? Don't be embarrassed. The code of Jewish law starts, don't be, you should know, there'll be a lot of scoffers. Many people make fun of you. Why are you eating matzah on the third day of Pesach? Are you crazy? What is this, crackers? They laugh at you. Why are you doing this? Why are you doing this? It's strange. It's not cool. It's not the in thing to do. There'll be many people. The whole world will be against you. Why Israel? You're this, you're yet. You have to be strong, you have to be firm, and not to be and be proud, and not to be afraid of what the rest of the world is saying. The whole world could be wrong, and we can be right. Not could be. They are. Continue.
Remember, pride and humility aren't contradictory. The pride and strength we are supposed to have doesn't derive from our own sense of self-importance. We are supposed to know full well our true state, that everyone else is better than us. We are the lowest of the mountains. Nevertheless, we act with pride and confidence toward Torah mitzvot because we know that we are fulfilling God's will. We are fully invested in fulfilling God's will, and this gives us the greatest strength and confidence, dismissing all obstacles from our path.
Mm-hmm. This is beautiful.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, what?
There's a sentence that we are supposed to know full well our true state, that everyone else is better than us. We're the lowest of the mountains. I don't quite understand what
I was just going to say, yeah.
He knows his own his spiritual state. That means to say, I know that I'm not good, and the other Jew is better than me, and I'm. That's why it keeps me humbleness. Because I know.
A Jew among Jew, though, not Jews compared to.
No, the point. Not even compared to every person. If I know what God is expecting of me, And I know that I'm not even beginning.
Okay.
And I look to myself in the mirror. I says, "You, where are you in the world?" But when it comes to do being representative, ambassador of God, being doing a mitzvah, I'm going to do what is supposed to be done because it's not me, it's God. It's about Him. It's not about me. It's not about my arrogance. I'm not fighting for my ego. I want to do what God meant. But you see, the ego is very, professional to take you over and even give you ego there, that you have to be make sure that you do. But the point is, when it comes to Jewish pride, you're strong no matter what. But
a better way to say it, maybe, that we're no better than anybody else.
That's what he say.
Because it almost sounds like we think we're inferior.
That's what he say. We are not better, and on a personal level, we are not better than anybody else. But on a collective level, and what we have to do in the name of God, we have to do what he's supposed to do, and we shouldn't be impressed by anybody's else opinions. That's what it's all about.
So really, it doesn't mean that, like my interpretation is, it's not that we're the lowest of the low. It's like, I'm no better than you. I'm no better than you.
You're right.
I'm the same. But when it comes to doing for God,
that's what I'm saying. We come to do for God. You're right. Then it's on a personal level, no, I'm not better. Being chosen doesn't mean being arrogant.
It's like lack of ego. I'm no...
Exactly.
It doesn't matter what I do, what you do, like, we're all, I'm no better than you.
Exactly. Lack of ego. Ego is a bad thing, but pride of who you're representing, that you should have a strong one. Yes. Being chosen doesn't mean to be arrogant, to look at other people down. Being chosen is a statement of responsibility. If God told me something to do, I better do it. Why he doesn't have to? He's not chosen. He was not appointed to do it. But I'm appointed. You know, you tell your child, I'm expecting from you to do this, but everybody else in class is not doing it. Everybody else in class is not my child. You're my child. From you, I'm expecting much more. The expectation we have to fill, God has from us huge expectations. But it doesn't mean we are arrogant because of it.
We probably all have said that. It doesn't matter what anyone else is doing. You're my son, you're my exactly. daughter, right?
We can be absolutely humble and at the same time be confident and strong in our acceptance and observance of the Torah with complete devotion.
I saw many, many people who were very, very humble and very strong and stubborn when it came to observe Judaism. Okay, we'll skip the story. You can read the story on your own. We'll give you the book later. we'll read B.
Desirable traits.
Yes.
The Mishnah's intention is not to list the chain of Torah tradition. This is evident from the fact that there were many more generations between Moses and the men of the Great Assembly than what the Mishnah includes. Maimonides provided a full list in his introduction to his commentary on the Mishnah and Mishneh Torah. The Mishnah's goal is
Excuse
to teach...
Me, two different ones, Mishnah and Mishneh Torah.
Mishnah is the Talmud. The Talmud, the Mishnah, the first part of the Talmud is the Mishnah. And Maimonides named his book with the same name, Mishneh Torah.
Okay.
But we call it Yad HaChazakah. Tradition gave it a different name because of this misunderstanding. Okay. But yeah, it's called Mishneh Torah. But it's two separate books, yeah, completely. Go ahead.
The Mishnah's goal is to teach us about the character traits that are necessary in order to study Torah. It's a good word, one. The necessary traits are those of Moses, Joshua, the elders, the prophets, and the men of the great assembly. The subject is an action that needs to be done as a preparation for Torah study, but a character trait a person needs to possess
to be successful in teaching in learning Torah. Want to continue?
Moses, humility. Humility is a necessary character trait in order to study Torah.
What the Rebbe is saying like this, you know, the Mishnah started like this. The Torah was Moses received the Torah from Sinai. He gave it to Joshua. Joshua to prophet. Prophet to oldest. Oldest to prophet. Prophet to people in the assembly. Then the Rebbe wants to make a point. Every one of them is another lesson. Moses is one character, one attribute that we need to learn Torah. Joshua represents the second one. Elders represent the third one, prophet the fourth one, and the people get the same. Five traits that we need to be able to be successful in learning Torah. Then we're starting with the first one. What is Moses? Moses is humility. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Okay. Humility is a necessary character trait in order to study Torah. This was exemplified by Moses, the most humble person, and also expressed by the giving of the Torah on Mount Sinai. We are instructed to learn from God's conduct, and God chose to give the Torah specifically on the small Mount Sinai because humility is a required quality for Torah.
Then Moses represents humility. Without humility, you cannot really be able to understand the Torah. When you come to the Torah, you have to come like a clean slate, like open-minded. You cannot say, oh, I will understand. Because then your mind starts to take you in certain direction. You're trying to make from the Torah what you want. Or let's try to... I'm looking for a leniency in this parsha. I'll find it. We'll make it work. That's not Torah. That you're making up your own story. You need to come open-minded. I'm going to learn Torah. Whatever the Torah tells me, that's what's going to be. I'm here to accept, to learn, not to put my own two cents inside. Continue.
It's a duplication.
Go ahead.
Humility is a necessary character trait in order to study Torah. This was exemplified by Moses, the most humble person, and also expressed by the giving of the Torah.
It's a duplication.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah?
Mount Sinai, it's the same, yeah.
Yeah, continue next paragraph.
The importance of humility is emphasized in the episode when Moses said, "The case that is too difficult for you, bring to me," a statement that didn't reflect humility. Moses was punished for this, and he forgot a few Torah laws. It should be noted that there is a difference between humility.
There's once a story with Moses that he told the people in the Bible. He appointed leaders, judges, and he said, anything that's too hard, bring to me. And I told them, oh, really, bring to you? Mm-hmm. And because of that, he forgot a few laws.
I thought that was a story where he did, like, he wasn't going to allow them to have conflict. He was going to take their conflict and, like, provide leadership.
Yes, but the way it was said, it was the wrong way to be said.
Yeah, it comes off as pretty arrogant.
Yeah.
Yeah, a little
bit.
You're
not smart enough to figure it out.
You're not smart enough. Come to me. Instead of saying, whatever you have a big question, I'll turn to God. I'll ask him, whatever there was. But right away, he was punished. Because when a special like Moses is saying something, see, when regular people say something stupid, it's not so bad. But then when Moses is saying something not perfect, he's being punished. He's being reminded right away because everybody learns from him.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a good line. Yeah, very good line. Go ahead.
It should be noted that there is a difference between humility and lowliness. Lowliness denotes the lack of positive qualities. By contrast, a humble person possesses many qualities, but does not ascribe any greatness to himself. Mm-hmm. Moses was aware of his positive qualities as the recipient of the Torah, and yet he was still humble. Similarly, every Jew needs to be humble as a prerequisite for Torah study. This is reflected in our prayers when we first say, let my soul be as dust to all, and then continue, open my heart to your Torah.
Beautiful. Now we go. Now we know Moses, we know already. We established that. We are already whole humble. Now we can move on to the next one. Joshua,
complete devotion. Regarding Joshua, the verse states, he would not depart from the tent. Joshua had many qualities, but now we are discussing his Torah-related qualities, and his absolute devotion was his greatest. Joshua studied Torah diligently with complete devotion.
Joshua was not married as long as Moses was alive. His whole life was the Torah. He only got married when he became a leader after Moses died. He never stepped away from Moses. When Moses went up in Mount Sinai, everybody else was in the camp. Joshua was by himself for 40 days waiting for Moses by the bottom of the mountain. And a portion of manna is to come special for him. That's devotion. That's dedication. And that's why he became the leader, because he was more than his Moses' children. They were doing other things. Joshua was just there. He had his Rebbe, and he all done to him, and didn't let him leave for a second. There is actually, the Talmud, the Medrash says a story that when Moses, before he died, he asked Joshua, you know, you have some questions? He told him, everything that you learned, I was there. I learned everything. Because of this arrogance, he forgot 300 laws. Just a lesson. Go ahead, continue.
After we have the quality of humility, we are told that our studies should be with complete devotion, never leaving the tent. We should have no other pursuits. Our sole concern should be the tent of Torah study. On this note, the Midrash states, the Torah was given specifically to the generation that received the manna. Of course, the Torah was given to the Jewish people of all generations. What the Midrash is teaching us is that when we study Torah, we need to do so with the same mindset as the generation that received the manna. That generation had no concerns. They received all of their needs from heaven. They had no other occupation aside from Torah study. We are instructed that when we study Torah, we should detach ourselves from all the other mundane concerns. Our Torah study should be our entire being, as it was for the generation of the manna. This was the quality exemplified by Joshua, who never left Moses' tent.
See, what means the generation of the manna? What means to learn Torah like Joshua? The F hour that you learn Torah, you come to a class, you learn Torah, you close down your cell phone, you are now learning Torah. The world can come to an end, I'm learning Torah. Whenever you learn, before this 10 minutes, be like Joshua. Be like, the world, nothing exists. Because if you pick up the phone and you do this and you do this, you have people interrupt you, you can never be focused. That this hour that you dedicated to God, don't do anything else. And then shut down everything and be focused. At this moment, you have nothing on your mind. Just like the people in the desert did not have any reason to worry. That manna from heaven, everything was provided, clouds of glory, nobody attacked them. They were like in college. Everything was provided. Life was great. And that's why they make all the troubles. That's why in the desert they complain. That's why in college they complain, because they have nothing else to do. But really, if somebody is, you can learn. You need a clean mind, a clear mind to be able to learn. If you're busy, if you're upset, or your mind is about other things, you cannot learn. You cannot concentrate. That's what you learn from Joshua. Complete devotion. Go ahead.
The elder's exertion. The above-mentioned qualities of humility and complete focus are prerequisites for Torah study, but they aren't sufficient. The study itself must be done with toil and exertion. This was exemplified by the Zekenim.
Skenim, the elders.
The Hebrew word Zeken is an abbreviation of one who has acquired wisdom.
Zekana Chochma. This elder doesn't mean he's an old man. Elder means he's a scholar. That's what it means.
Shouldn't it be capitalized?
Isn't Zakain mean old man, though?
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. That they took the word and said, we don't mean literally an old man. We mean Zakain is an acronym of Zekana Chochma. This person bought, purchased, acquired wisdom.
The only way to acquire Torah so that it becomes like our possession is through exertion. When we exert ourselves over Torah...
Exertion, guys. Just like you cannot do exercise if you... Oh, I like to do exercise. You know, I like playing on a piano. Well, actually, exercise, that's not for me. Go ahead.
When we exert ourselves over Torah, it is not like a gift or an inheritance which comes automatically. It is a possession we have acquired through our effort.
You cannot really learn Torah if you don't really put your life into it and work hard and learn hours and hours and hours. It doesn't come like you know, you read the newspaper, that's interesting. It doesn't work like this. Right? Not in college either. You don't learn. You have to learn for the test. It's hard. It's complicated. Okay. The prophets, divine
assistance. In order to understand Torah properly, we need special divine assistance. As the Talmud says, in order for a person to merit that their Torah rulings should be accepted, they need divine assistance. This is the underlying concept of prophecy, divine assistance.
What means divine assistance? You know, when a rabbi needs to give a ruling, he should give the right ruling. He needs divine assistance to come up to the right decision. There is many opinions in Judaism, in the Talmud and everywhere. To reach the right conclusion, you need God's help. There is a famous story the Rebbe mentioned a few times about a rabbi came to a city. And you know, every rabbi has some opponents who drive him crazy. The greater the rabbi, the more opponents he has. That used to ask him many questions to try to turn him off. And every time he gave the right answer. One time, he gave the wrong answer. Oh, they were so excited that they came to him. He asked one question. Was this a question just for a question, or really somebody had to live by this? He said, no, we just made it up, the question, just to give it to you. He says, okay, that's okay, he says. When I'm a rabbi, when it becomes a practical question, God helps me to make the right decision that a Jew should not make the wrong things. He has to live by it, he has to do it. Now it's just a question for the sake of a question. Hypothetical question. God doesn't have to help me. God doesn't have to make me right. Basically God tells the rabbi, go learn better, don't make mistakes. If it's a matter of somebody is coming and is asking, Rabbi, is this kosher or treif? Should I do it this way or this way? Is this pure or impure? God will not let the rabbi make a mistake because the Jew will make the mistake that he's helping him to come to the right decision. He says, if it was just a hypothetical question, it's your problem. I'm not here to protect your honor. Next time, learn a little better. That's why the rabbi said, I'm not surprised I made a mistake. I'm not perfect. But when you learn Torah, you need God's assistance, God's help, God's intervention to make sure you have come to the right conclusions. You don't turn the Torah upside down. Continue.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
So you're a rabbi and you have to make so many decisions. Do you feel that godly intervention at times?
Sometimes, yeah.
I mean, is it just does it just come to you? Does it just hit
you? No, it just comes to me. Yeah, sometimes. Many times I make stupid things. Yeah, but sometimes. Yeah, sure. You feel that you tell people things that you don't think it has any effect, and then 20 years later, yeah, absolutely, many times.
Okay.
It's all from God. I mean, everything good is from God. I can tell you that. But when I talk politics, then I get in trouble. So when it's not God. I shouldn't talk politics. Mm-hmm. It's only get in trouble. Continue.
The men of the great assembly studied to observe. The Talmud says that one can only rule by actual precedent, not by intellectual understanding.
Continue, source 3.
Source 3. The sages taught one cannot derive a practical ruling from theoretical study, nor from witnessing someone's practical example, but only after inquiring as to the correct ruling and being explicitly told what to do.
You know what? This next part. Basically, continue. Let them continue in the bottom. Right there, yes.
When the study is relevant to actual practice, it is of a completely different quality.
As it explained, go ahead.
Explains that when a person is studying in order to reach a practical conclusion, the effort they exert is much greater, and this helps them reach the correct conclusion. This was the role of the men and of the great assembly to issue practical
Very good. Then what he says is like this. Then we have the five levels. Moses is humbleness. Joshua is commitment. The elders are making an effort to learn Torah. The prophet tells us we need divine assistant. And the people of the great assembly is then we have to bring it down to practical rules. Then what's the bottom line? Many times, you give a class, people tell you, Rabbi, whatever you want, just make up your mind. What's the bottom line? You need to make sure that when people come out from a class, they come out, it's something, there is a bottom line to it. There is a clear conclusion, a clear rule. Not every rabbi is capable to. He has so many big. Sometimes the more they are scholarly, the more they know, the more it's hard for them to come down to a bottom line.
Well, so much for courses in philosophy.
Well, yeah.
The rabbi was beyond our imagination somewhat in many ways. So how could he come out with a talk to an average person with a very, very, very mundane question, and he should be able to comfortably respond and do it? I mean, this is remarkable.
It's connected.
That's not because it was... He was so great that he was able to relate to every person. That's a part of the greatness. Usually, geniuses cannot relate to regular people. The Rebbe was so unique about him, that he was able to relate to a little child and tell him something that will turn him around and relate on his level. The Rebbe answered to little children.
He
Yeah.
That's the thing.
You're right.
Yeah, but very remarkable when you look at it.
You're right. The Rebbe was something.
but everybody's connected to God. He's connected to God.
More than everybody, sure. Okay, we'll continue. Now is a new thing. It's about, we spoke about it yesterday. It's about Yeshua ben Parachia, a very famous rabbi. The rabbi is not so famous, but the disciple is a little more famous than him. Go ahead, Mr. Schulman.
The rejection of Jesus of Nazareth, Mission 6. Yehoshua ben Parachia, and Nittai
Arbeli
received from them. Yehoshua ben Parachia said, appoint for yourself a teacher, acquire for yourself a friend, and judge everyone favorably.
Right, that's the Mishnah. The Mishnah says a few things. Make yourself a rabbi, it's a good thing. And get yourself buy yourself a student, acquire a student, and judge every person favorably. Go ahead, the Bartenura, not the wine, the rabbi. Continue.
Appoint for yourself a teacher. One teacher who will constantly guide you. Not one teacher one day, another teacher another the next day. Acquire a friend, even if you need to pay him a lot of money to acquire his friendship. Judge everyone favorably. When a matter could go either way and isn't immediately obvious, for example, a person who we do not know his reputation did an action that could be viewed positively or negatively, we ought to judge him favorably. However, one who is known as a sinner may be judged negatively.
That's what the commentary said. But there is more to it. Go ahead, number four. This is the story with actually Jesus. What happened?
This is kind of weird statement here. It's like,
why?
Do it by reputation more than anything. If somebody known as something positive, then judge him favorably. However, he's known as a sinner, maybe judge negatively. Without kind of all the facts
that's
to the T, you know?
Right.
It's like assume innocence.
Yeah, assume him innocent
by
until most of the people you assume innocent until they prove him guilty. But he says here, the Bartenura says, but if you know he's a guilty guy, assume him guilty. This is before Hasidus came around. That's 500 years ago. Then came the Baal Shem Tov and turned it upside down and said, you judge every person favorably. That's what it's all about. As you see from the story with what happened with Jesus himself.
When Yahai decreed to kill all the decreed to kill all the sages, Shimon ben Sharpah was hidden by his sister and Rabbi Yehoshua ben Parachia, and Jesus fled to Alexandria.
Yeah, there were two rabbis. Basically, Yehoshua ben Parachia and his disciple Jesus ran away to Egypt because there was a Jewish king, Yana, who decided to kill all the rabbis. And they run away. A Jewish king, not a Gentile. We have all the tzoras from
When the king was made peace with the sages, Shimon ben Sadach summoned Rabbi Yehoshua to return. He went, and on his way, stayed at an inn, where he was treated with the great respect. What a beautiful hostess, he exclaimed. But her eyes are ugly, said Jesus. Wicked one is that what you are occupied with, said Rabbi Yehoshua.
What happened is, he came to an inn, the rabbi and his disciple, the famous disciple, and they treated them very well. And the rabbi gave a compliment about the place, about the inn, there's such a nice place. And the student said, your eyes are ugly. She has ugly eyes. That's what he said about the woman, the hostess. And the rabbi was very upset. How dare you say such a thing? What's your business to insult a woman like this? What is this? He was angry at him. Go ahead. But your eyes are ugly, said.
He said, we got away with this. And Rabbi Yehoshua, he brought 400 shofars and excommunicated Jesus.
He threw him out of the yeshiva. Finished. Out. I don't want to talk to you. I don't want to see you. Every day,
Jesus returned and asked to be re-accepted, and Rabbi Yehoshua ignored him.
Mm-hmm.
One day, while the rabbi was reciting the Shema, Jesus came and asked to be accepted back. Rabbi Yehoshua gestured with his hand, and Jesus thought that he was rejecting him. He took the stone and bowed to
him. He showed up in the wrong time. But then by Rabbi Yeshua, by that time, wanted to accept him. He changed his mind. He said, if he comes one more time, I will take him. And he told them, just wait. He made him a gesture with his hand, but he didn't understand. And he said, oh, my rabbi doesn't want me. He went and he worshipped idols.
Maybe he's not going to stop in the middle of the Shema, right?
Now he didn't know that he's saying Shema.
He solved a lot of
the student did not know that he's saying Shema. You know, when Jews make signs with the hand, you never understand what they really mean. Is it a good sign or a bad sign? Repent, the rabbi said, continue.
Repent, the rabbi said.
The rabbi called him back after he sinned, after he worshipped idols. He said, come back, I still want you back.
You have taught me that one who sins and leads others astray and never repent, responded Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
One sage said Jesus performed sorcery and led others astray.
Basically, he tried to bring him back, and it was too late. He said, oh, I know that I'm doomed. You taught me that if somebody worships idols, he's doomed. Then I don't want to come back. Continue.
Finding merit in everyone.
Yeshua ben Prachya.
Yeshua ben Prachya certainly knew what he himself said about one who sins and the other who sins. Why then did he say to Jesus, repent? The answer lies in another teaching that constantly repeated, judge every person favorably. Yehoshua himself acted accordingly and always looked for the positive in others. He must therefore have found some merit in Jesus as well, even after he sinned and led others astray. He tried to draw him back. In this case, it was indeed too late, and Jesus did not come back. But we need to learn from this story the lesson that we can never reject another Jew, regardless of their state. We must care even for a lost sheep and judge every person favorably. As the Talmud itself clarifies, we should not push away people with both hands like
Yeshua ben Prachya did. Then what you learn from here is, the Rebbe says, look, his rabbi tried to bring him back even after he sinned. He didn't want to give up on them. He didn't want to come. But you learn, Yeshua ben Prachya came with this teaching because he made the mistake, because he pushed them away. And he saw what came out from it. He went around every day of his life and he says, judge every person favorably. No matter what they do. Even the worst wicked, not like the Bartanura says, that if he's wicked, you judge him not favorably. You judge every... That's what the Rebbe wanted to learn from this story. And especially now in our generation that nobody's... Is he intentionally doing bad? Then for sure you have to judge him favorably. We'll skip the source number 5. We'll go straight to the Rebbe.
The Rebbe said, Yehoshua ben Prachya not rejected Jesus when he came and wished to return. All of his later actions wouldn't have happened. All the terrible troubles and suffering that the Jewish people suffered throughout the generations as a result of him would have been spared.
You see what the Rebbe says? If Yeshua ben Prachya would welcome back Jesus, all the sorrows of the Jewish people that went through Christianity, all this would be avoided, would be saved from it. All because the rabbi was too strict with the students. How much we learn, how much we have to be judge every person favorably. Go ahead.
Emphasize the importance of judging every person favorably. Because he saw the result of rejecting someone.
Exactly. Continue. Give him to
someone. I must learn from this episode not to reject anyone and to always search for the positive in others, even if in a slow state. When a person is in the middle of reciting the Shema, as Yehoshua ben Prachya.
Even when a person is in the middle of writing a Shema, that's missing here a word, even when a person.
Meditating on the most profound levels of the divine unity, and someone comes and asks them for help, they may think that they cannot interrupt it in order to help other persons.
He thinks he cannot do it. Finish it.
Me?
Yeah, you.
The story of Yehoshua ben Prachya teaches us that this is incorrect. We should not act like Yehoshua ben Prachya, who rejected with both hands, and must immediately concern ourselves with helping them.
Why the story is teaching us? It was in the middle of the Shema. A person said, what means it mean this? I'm in the middle of such a holy thing. He's coming and bothering me. I'm praying now. How dare you talk? How dare you move me? How dare you do? stop whatever you do and assist the other Jew, even in the middle of Shema, because you can, because if not, you can turn him off completely. And it's very important in a synagogue like by us, then people come and talk or ask you a question in the middle of something that's very important to you, pray, and you get irritated. The people in the back talk, and the people in the this. Think about Yeshua and Pachya and about his disciple. And when you'll think about it, you will be a little more patient. Thank you all for joining for the long class.
No, we don't. Jesus.